As many of you, I think, are aware, we have a problem with unexamined evidence kits in this state, which means a lot of people are running around who shouldn't be because they've committed crimes and haven't been held to account for them. And here in our state, more than 8,000 rape kits, some of them decades old, were still sitting on police evidence shelves awaiting testing in the lab. And our state attorney general brought an expert in to look at what the crime lab needs. And Chi Radio's Hannah Scott took a pilgrimage down to, this is in Vancouver,
Vancouver,
right?
Mm-hmm.
To take a look at what they're doing. So tell us what the setup is there.
So it is much smaller than you might think, right? It's not as big as, like, if you ever watch CSI and shows like that. They're very, it's a smaller building. And they said that most of our crime labs across the state are like that. Amy Jean-Bonneau, she is a DNA technology expert who helps labs across the country and become more efficient by updating their process, getting better equipment, and better communicating with police and prosecutors to really make the process work better all around. Work that she started doing nearly 20 years ago.
The big change occurred like 1999, 2000, when New York City discovered that they had a large finding of unsubmitted kits. Their number was around 19,000. And the laboratory I worked for was part of testing those kits. And it sort of started a launch in how to do that more efficiently and how can we be better at getting results from sexual assault kits.
Jean-Bonneau says they quickly realized New York was not an isolated incident.
From there, you had backlogs that came out of Los Angeles and then Houston and Detroit. And all this time, you know, working on the private side, we'd be visiting with crime laboratories and asking, this can't be limited to these big cities. Like, there's got to be a bigger issue.
And they were absolutely right. At the height of this nationwide issue, there were an estimated 400,000 untested rape kits sitting on police shelves across the country. Now, with new technology and training from Jean-Bonneau and others and better communication between states, cities, and law enforcement, there has been some significant progress on the national level, with that 400,000 believed now to be less than half of that, under 200,000 still untested. Our state has not made as much progress as others, and that's why the AG called in Jean-Bonneau. This past week, scientists from the State Patrol crime labs across the state gathered at that Vancouver crime lab for a day-long conference with her to talk about what's working and what's not and what they need and what they already have that might be able to speed up the process. Now, in October, official statewide inventory was finally complete, showing 6,500 unsubmitted kits still on store shelves, police evidence shelves. Agencies across the state started doing massive submissions all at once, 600 kits at a time going to some of these labs.
So it was actually more out there than they thought because the cops had just decided not to submit them?
Well, and they hadn't. So what led up to this, and I talked to the crime lab manager about this, across the country, there's been a lot of studies on this done, but essentially there were, back in the day, if it was a he said, she said kind of a case, mm-hmm. the cops wouldn't submit it because they didn't think it could get prosecuted, things of that nature. But then in 2015, we mandated here that all new kits have to be sent for testing. And we've been waiting for federal funds, and we did a final count just this year to figure out how many were still on the police evidence shelves. And that was about 6,500 with another 2,000 or so that were in the process of being tested. So it's a lot. And Vancouver lab manager Bruce Siggins says it can take a toll on the scientists.
One of the things about forensic scientists is they always own their backlog. One of the things we are looking at is what's coming in, what am I getting done, what am I getting out? And you take that home with you. You want to get it done. You want to have that number going down. We don't have a situation where scientists are panicking, certainly, but they're still seeing coming in faster and faster and faster, and it reaches that point of, how do we handle this? What do we do? We're not winning this. People want to win. They want to succeed.
And he says, as our labs and labs across the country continue testing these kits, it has become abundantly clear why succeeding is vital, not just for the particular rape victim in question, but for everyone.
This encounter here seems like a relatively simple story. We don't have any violent evidence. But if we run this kit and we upload that profile in the CODIS, and suddenly this person is popping up in more than one space, and suddenly this person's innocent story doesn't sound so innocent because there's a pattern. And so I think that was the information that nobody really knew was out there.
And as kits are tested, I know other cities, Detroit, found multiple serial rapists when they completed many of their
And that's the bottom line here. You have people who should be locked up who haven't been because this stuff has been sitting in police storage. So What is it going to cost for them to get this done? And is there any question of the legislature approving it?
There's always a question with the legislature, right? So there's going to be, and I'm going to be back here in the 8 o'clock hour to tell you more about the legislative asks. What they got out of this is this particular lab, Vancouver lab, has an empty space upstairs that's just sitting there. What they want is to turn that into what's known as a high throughput lab. It cuts the testing time down from a year or more to 25 to 45 days. They need some more staff. They need some more equipment. But they've already got the design all up. I've been in there and they've showed it to me. It's great. Another thing that they might need to look for that I'll talk about more in the 8 o'clock hours. I was shocked. They have no digitization here. Everything is
no
paper.
No computers?
Nothing.
On CSI,
all
the records. They got holograms.
Look, they don't even have Wi-Fi, right? So that's one of the things that they were talking about.
Holy cow.
Because, right, they want to use tablets when they're walking around in their lab, but they don't have Wi-Fi, not at any of the labs across the state. There is so much that needs to be done to get this going. So there's going to be a big ask at the legislature. I'll tell you more about that in the 8 o'clock hour.
Very good. Thank you, Hannah. Mm-hmm. It is Hannah Scott. Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Maybe you saw this headline in the New York Times. Scant evidence behind the advice about salt. Does this mean salt is not harmful after all? Let's consult the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, I remember that my grandfather actually was put on a low-salt diet, and all his food, grandma kept all his food separate from everybody else. He had no-salt bread. Of course, his food was never salted, which was tough on him, but she was convinced that salt had essentially become poison because he had a heart condition. So that has changed now?
You know, you hear a lot about low-salt diets and not eating salt. Salt can give you high blood pressure and so on and so forth. But there's not really much data to actually back that up. So there's been a number of scientific studies done actually questioning the usefulness of low-salt diets in the last few years. And despite those studies, they don't really demonstrate that there's any major problems or any real issues. However, most major medical organizations continue to recommend low-salt diets. With respect to heart failure, which is really the thing that we worry about most, there's actually a very small amount of evidence. So first of all, what is heart failure? Heart failure is when the heart just doesn't squeeze or pump well enough to get the blood out to the body. And almost 6 million people in the United States every year suffer from it. Now, one of the things that causes or is related to heart failure is chronic high blood pressure. And it's because when you have high blood pressure, the heart has to do extra amount of work. It's working essentially overtime, and that the heart isn't designed to do that extra work. It's designed to do it periodically, like when we exercise, but it's not meant to do it chronically. And so when that happens, the heart actually becomes thickened, and then it becomes weakened, and it leads to heart failure. And so one of the things that's recommended is usually trying to strengthen the squeeze or the contraction of the heart with drugs and reducing the volume of blood with other drugs like diuretics, or here's the key thing, restricting salt intake. So this is one of the major recommendations that is made by many different medical organizations.
That's wrong now? Is that what we're saying?
There was a study that just came out in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It was a review of other scientific studies, and they looked at 9 unique studies with 479 unique patients that had heart failure. And what they ended up finding is that there was really no evidence that there was any improvement in heart failure with restriction of salt intake. That's a pretty important finding. Now, oftentimes people think about, well, salt and its relationship to high blood pressure. And there was another study that was published in Lancet, which is, we've talked about before, is one of the world's leading medical journals. And in this study, they looked at the effect of salt on blood pressure, and they found something really interesting. A half a teaspoon of salt has only the effect of about 2 or 3 millimeters of increase in blood pressure. So when we talk about 120 over 80, for example, we're talking about instead 122 or 123 over 80. So it was really a minimal effect. So all of this concern that we have about eating too much salt is not really been scientifically proven.
That's interesting. So as you were talking, I was Googling the subject to see what the internet would, you know, would tell somebody who wants to look this up. And this is from Harvard. And it says that Americans have too much salt in their diet, which raises blood pressure, and too little potassium, which lowers blood pressure. So, I mean, if you're Googling this these days, you'll still get the old advice with no indication that this evidence is confined to these very small studies.
Right. So that's the thing, is all the different medical organizations, including the American Heart Association, for example, they all will make the recommendation of lowering salt in your diet. But really, in the studies that have been reviewed, there was really no data that showed that salt restriction would actually result in a reduction in mortality or a reduction in cardiac disease. And it didn't have any effect on whether someone was admitted to the hospital or not. And the amount of salt you can consume didn't influence how long you had to stay in the hospital if you were admitted. Here's the thing. Eating too much salt, there's no evidence to show that it actually will result in high blood pressure, but there's no question that if you actually reduce salt intake, that you could lower your blood pressure some. The real question is what is the effect of that reduction in blood pressure, and was it meaningful on the other outcomes, i.e., is it meaningful to the amount of heart failure that you have? Is there a reduction in mortality or cardiac disease? Is there a reduction in the amount of time you spend in the hospital if you're admitted? And so forth.
If you're diagnosed with high blood pressure, then is there any dietary thing you can do to avoid having to be put on a drug regimen?
Usually, if you have hypertension, you have to make a lifestyle change, and that involves an increase in your activity with more exercise. Clearly, you can get down to normal blood pressure with diet and exercise alone in most people, but it usually requires a combination of the two. Your heart will become healthier. It'll function better. Your blood vessels will respond better. You'll change your overall blood volume. And so it's really the combination of diet plus exercise that works rather than just dietary changes alone.
Very good. Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Let's go to CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. The shutdown is now affecting employment numbers. Jill, how's this going to break down?
Well, look, this is starting to have a broader impact on the overall economy because obviously the longer it goes on, the more that we are going to see spillover effects. So let's start with the obvious point, which is when 800,000 people don't get paid, their personal financial lives go into wild turmoil. But the next level is that there are people who serve those 800,000 people. They may be small business owners. They may be the local gas station. They may be a diner. You know, you don't know. And there are knock-on effects, meaning that the impact of those people not spending money starts to actually have an impact on others around them. And then more broadly, what we know is by looking back into past shutdowns, specifically, I would say the one in 2013 is probably going to give us the best idea here, is that we know that overall U.S. growth will start to take a hit. And we are now looking at many growth estimates being downgraded by economists. They're saying that, oh, listen, instead of 2.75% for the first quarter of this year, maybe it's going to be 2.5%. So a quarter of a percent may not sound like a lot, but at a time when we're already worried about growth slowing down, this can have an impact. And that's really what you're seeing in the stock market, frankly, is that the uncertainty of what's going to happen next can cause investors to start to say, we're not so sure what we want to do here. Let's kind of take a pause. This is all really going to be important because as this goes on longer and longer, what we don't know is how many of the parts of the economy are going to be impacted because we won't have data. We will not have data about retail sales this week. We will not have data about housing or manufacturing or trade data. So all of this is very important because, again, uncertainty breeds a lot of anxiety and can hurt the market, which then again can feed back into the overall economy.
I didn't realize that. So all the stuff that investors depend on to make their decisions going forward, those reports are not coming out at all?
Some of them are. So there are two parts of the government that will be very much open for business. The Labor Department is thankfully open. The Federal Reserve also will be sending out data. But again, Census Bureau is not. The Bureau of Economic Analysis is not. And I think it's just really hard for people and economists and investors to feel comfortable making bets going forward or making predictions without having a real feel for what's going on.
In terms of the financial impact, though, Congress has passed a law, as they usually do, saying that back pay will be provided once this is over. And that won't that make up for it? That'll provide a cash infusion, won't it?
Well, it should, but there's something very unusual, which is a good chunk of the people impacted by this shutdown, they are contractors, and those folks are not going to recoup those lost wages or those lost payments. And that's a problem, right? So a lot of the, you know, a lot of the government has gone to contractors, and that was a way to kind of reduce headcount, right? And those contractors, they're not going to get back pay. So it's going to be really tough for those folks. Look, they're going to have to go out and talk to their mortgage companies and their credit card companies and their auto loan companies and pretty much beg for forgiveness during this period.
But then that would also mean, because people say, well, we're not going to save any money anyway with a shutdown like this. But if the contractors are not going to be reimbursed, I know it's bad for them. I don't want to diminish that. But that also means the government does save some money, doesn't it?
No. So, sorry. I know that was a good thought, though. I like that. Based on contingency planning and lost user fees and the back pay that many of those people will get, it's estimated that the shutdown right now is probably going to cost taxpayers about $2
billion. $2
billion,
all told?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not a huge number. No, I mean, it's a trillion-dollar economy, but I'd like to have $2 billion back. I'm sure the president would like $2 billion towards his wall.
That's a good point. This is all, we're fighting this over $5.6 billion, and you're saying that we just set fire to $2 billion of that.
Right. Okay. And it's going to get bigger.
And it's going to get bigger. So the $5.6 billion wall is going to, assuming he gets it, is now going to cost us $11.2
billion. Yeah, it's rough.
Thank you, Jill.
Sorry.
Your daily dose of kindness now. It's a bit of a role reversal. TSA workers are the ones standing in line at Denver International Airport this weekend for what was essentially a free lunch. The two-man volunteer group known as Boots 66 gave away about 2,000 meals with the overarching goal to feed every TSA employee currently working without pay during the partial government shutdown. Organizer Wes Love says he knows making ends meet, even putting food on the table, no easy feat given the partial government shutdown.
A lot of them are young. A lot of them are just starting out and they don't have the money and they're living paycheck to paycheck.
Boots 66 originally formed to honor soldiers killed in action, but over time, the group evolved into an organization that gives back to people forced into situations out of their control. This would certainly count. Also, along the same line, headlines this weekend, air traffic controllers in Canada sent hundreds of pizzas to our TSA agents. They say it's a sign of support and solidarity with their U.S. counterparts.
Time for a Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, direct from 710 ESPN, Danny O'Neill. First of all, Seahawks have a new kicker?
They do. Kicking Sam Ficken.
I like it.
That's right. Sam Ficken, previously cut by the Rams. Because that's what you have to do this time. You're sorting through the recycle bin.
When was he cut from the Rams?
Last season when their kicker, Greg Zuerlein, came back.
They're good this season. I thought if he came from the good season.
He filled in 5 weeks, their great kicker, Greg Zuerlein. Greg the Leg is what they call him. When Greg the Leg was injured, this guy came in. Kicking Sam Ficken came in to kick in the interim.
So Seabass is out, huh?
Seabass is most definitely out. You've heard my theory on kickers, right?
Well, you've always characterized them as being some of the weirdest human beings you've ever met.
That's correct. I now believe that when you choose whether or not to keep a kicker, the spoiled milk analogy should apply. The second time you have to sniff it and think, is this still good? That's when you throw it out. The first time you can go ahead and talk yourself into it. You're like, I don't know if this is any good anymore.
Well,
you take a sniff. Do you think this is good? Well,
that's
try
when you,
we'll
that's when you make
sick.
One of those recipes that requires sour milk.
The second time you do that, a.k.a. buttermilk, the second time you do that, throw it out. And if they would have done that, the Seahawks would have done that this season, we would have avoided him actually popping his hamstring. He's the only kicker I've seen actually injure himself while kicking.
It was something else to watch. Oh, well. A lot of people making a comment about his age. Was he too old to be a kicker?
40 years old? No, it's not his age, because Adam Vinatieri has been kicking to 46. Mm. It was the age combined with the fact that he looked like a beer truck delivery driver.
He's a massive guy.
I don't think he emphasized the physical fitness part of the job, and he certainly wasn't going to make a mistake and tackle anybody.
Right, right. If Seabass is listening, this is just the way Danny is. Okay, he says this about everybody. Kyler Murray, tell me about this young man.
He is a Heisman-winning football player.
Right.
who was also selected in the top 10 in the first round of the baseball draft by the Oakland A's, who gave him $4.7 million. It's right under $5 million to sign to play baseball because he's also a baseball prospect. Well, he has a heck of a football season, and now it's possible he's going to enter the NFL draft.
Why? Why? If he can get $4.7 million up front, I assume that's guaranteed, right?
Yes, it is. It's a check. You get it right now.
Well, heck, what's to decide?
Well, if he's a first-round pick, he's probably going to be guaranteed $8 million over the next 4 years.
Oh, I see.
He's also, if he's a first-round pick, he's not going to play minor league baseball, a.k.a. bus rides everywhere. He would be in position to know that he would earn more, and it'll be interesting to see. The A's and Major League Baseball apparently are talking to him, they might sweeten the pot because he's already taken the money from them. He would have to give them the money back.
But baseball, I thought baseball was guaranteed money, whereas football is full of incentives.
That's correct. But a rookie quarterback drafted in the first round, he would make the $8 million. He would see the end of that contract. It is fully guaranteed. And if you had a 10-year baseball career in the major leagues compared to a 10-year football career, at almost any position, you would out-earn that in baseball. Quarterback's the exception.
Yeah. And this guy's not a quarterback, though, is he?
He is.
Oh, yeah. He is a quarterback.
Yeah, he plays quarterback. It's possible. It's a bad quarterback.
Seems like
draft.
Rolling the dice, and you're still, I mean, you're not going to get a concussion in baseball unless you get smacked. You're not a pitcher, right?
These are all great arguments to consider, Dave. You're right. But there's also no guarantee you're going to make the major leagues by signing a baseball. Mm-hmm. Top 10 picks all the time. In fact, the Mariners just signed one. Tim Beckham, mm-hmm. who was the number one overall pick in 2008, and is available for a one-year contract.
Why does it take so long, by the way? I never asked this question. Why does it take so long to get on to the big show in baseball, whereas you can go straight out of college to the big show in the NFL?
Probably some of the game. That's probably part of it. The nature of the game and that the level of difficulty for the physical demands for a football player. Guys coming out of college are more ready to meet those in football compared to baseball, which is more a craft. So you have to become acclimated to the skill and precision of big league competition. I'm not sure. It used to be. There have been guys that have gone straight to the big leagues. Pete Incaviglia did it.
Is there less opportunity on the roster, too?
If you were good enough, they would make space for you. But yeah, you're right, Colleen. 25 guys on a baseball roster, 53 on an NFL roster. But the reality is that a guy who's played 3 years of college football and has been great is going to start in the NFL, where a guy that's played 3 years of college baseball and has been great, he's probably 2 to 3 years away from making the major leagues.
Well, it's a nice problem to have.
It would be great.
Do I take the $4 million or the $8 million?
The bird in the hand worth how many in the bush leagues?
Yeah, exactly.
Sounds like he's got a bird in both hands.
Yeah, it does.
Our Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. I hope one of them is a duck and he's strangling it.
Oh,
Sully.
You got to go there.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. The NRA has a point in the debate over guns and schools that the police are always late to a school shooting. And if you're going to nip it in the bud, then somebody either in the classroom or on the staff is probably going to have to take action. And thousands of teachers and staffers have decided to do just that by taking active shooter training. And Jay Willis has a piece in GQ magazine based on your visit to one of these courses. This course was given where, Jay?
This was in rural Adams County, Ohio.
And it put on by a private organization?
That's correct. It's put on by an Ohio nonprofit called the Buckeye Firearms Association.
And is it especially for school staff members and teachers?
It is, yes. It was specially designed in the weeks and months after the Sandy Hook shooting in, I believe, December 2012.
Now, what you describe sounds like the shoot or don't shoot training that police officers get. Is it modeled on that or something different?
To my knowledge, it's a creation of this man named John Benner, who runs sort of a private self-defense firing range in Ohio, along with, I believe they also recruited EMTs, firearms instructor, to create a really new curriculum. The test that teachers and staffers take at the end of it, is based off of Ohio's test for law enforcement. But the curriculum itself is specially designed for educators.
This is 3 days?
3 days, yes.
And based on your article, they put the teachers, basically, they try to create realistic active shooter situations and train them to react in a responsible way.
That's correct. So the first day is reserved mostly for sort of basic firearms training, especially for the teachers perhaps who don't have as much experience. The second day, there are some of those sort of drills that we talk about where they run into these live firehouses and there are paper targets in there. And if the paper target is not threatening, they are trained to obviously move on from it and to sort of search out the threatening paper target that is in the back room. There's also a crash course in emergency medicine that's put on by a few EMTs. That's after dinner on the second day. And then the third and final day, we move to exercises that actually use role players. So we use airsoft pistols and sort of enact these scenarios in real life.
Yeah, and that's where it gets pretty intense from what I understand in the article. So you met a kindergarten teacher who you call Pam. How would you describe her feelings going into this?
So Pam had never shot a handgun before preparing for this course. She told me that she went to a cousin's property who was more familiar with handguns, and he sort of let her try out different models to see which one she would feel most comfortable with. So by the time we met, she had only been shooting just to familiarize herself for about 3 months. And she felt very strongly that it was important that she be there to protect her children. And I say that because it's both her students and also her own children her attend own the school at which she works. Yeah. She was also very honest, though, about how in over her head she felt, how she was all nerves. And that's really sort of what drew me to her.
Yeah. One of the situations involves a suicide where student shoots himself, is there on the floor with the gun. Another student comes up on the scene and decides to be prudent to take the gun away. And at that point, the teacher enters, seeing a student holding a gun and another dead student. And that strikes me as one of those situations where it'd be really easy to make a bad mistake.
I mean, if you put yourself in the teacher's shoes there, you don't know what's going to happen in the scenario before the drill begins, obviously. And the only prompt the teacher was given was, I heard a gunshot and screaming. And so the teacher runs into the library or the lunchroom or wherever this happened. And you're right. What do they see? They see a body on the ground and somebody holding a gun above it. And in the scenario, the instructors were very careful to set it up so that the kid who picked up the gun, he didn't pick it up by the handle. He didn't have his finger on the trigger. It was in a non-shooting position, but he did have it in his hand. But the teacher, you know, you're running into there and you're looking for something to shoot. You have this idea, this paradigm in your head of what a school shooting looks like.
Yeah.
And so if you see a person and a body, that's the person to which your eye goes. And teacher after teacher shot that kid in the back.
Yeah. And then there's the other scenario where a shooter basically takes the school secretary hostage, puts a gun to her head, and the armed teacher coming to the rescue decides to yell freeze first. And what happens?
A person with a gun can react to you if you announce yourself faster than you can respond. And so in this case, the parent who was holding the secretary hostage heard the warning of the armed teacher and shot the secretary and then turned and attempted to exchange fire with the teacher. Now, fortunately, in this case, after the first gunshot, the teacher was able to fire first. But that's a situation in which there were two bodies where there could have been one.
Right. So in that situation, you should not have yelled freeze. You should have just shot.
It's a really interesting problem that came up over and over again in the training. We were consistently told, because of this reaction time discrepancy, when you find the shooter, do not announce yourself. Do not give them an opportunity to take away your element of surprise. Just shoot.
Yeah.
And in that situation, you can see why that would have been a good warning. Now, in the suicide scenario we talked about, you can see why it wasn't correct. Now, again, there is a discrepancy between the two. In the one case, the teacher was holding the secretary hostage. In the other case, you have somebody holding a gun, not in a firing position. But those are little tiny distinctions that for people who don't have years of training and experience in law enforcement, they may not pick up in the moment.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of risks that come out of this.
And so Pam learns this in 3 days. She gets her certificate as she says in your piece that she feels confident, and so she is going to be carrying a gun into the kindergarten class now.
Correct. Yes,
it'll be out in the it'll be in a holster, but in the open where she can reach it.
It will be concealed on her, but yes, it will be on her person.
Wow. Now, the people who run this active shooter exercise, I don't know if they're aware of the law we passed here in Washington State, which require a what sounds like a similar training course to anybody who buys any gun over the age of 21 in this state. You think they would object to a requirement like that, that a course like this be required for people who want to purchase a firearm?
I walked through many sort of common gun safety legislation proposals with the people who put the course on. And I said, do you think that this would make us safer? Independent of whether you think teachers should be armed, mm-hmm. do you think this would help? And to each one, they said no.
Really?
Yes.
Even the required training?
Oh, yes.
Why not? Since they obviously think it's valuable, they're running this course.
To them, requiring training is an infringement on their Second Amendment right.
Well, I guess in a way it is, as long as you eliminate the first half of the Second Amendment, which says a well-regulated militia. I mean, what does that mean?
You'll have to ask them. That's something that always seems to slip out of this debate. I agree.
Yeah. Jay Willis writes for GQ and is also a practicing attorney. You just sort of fell into this writing gig?
I did. I am no longer practicing. My bar membership isn't active, but it is still around for another year or two. It's always there to go back to, I suppose.
It's a good fallback to have. Jay, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
It is the first day of legislative session. Hannah Scott, you ready to throw yourself another session, Hannah?
I am, and it's the long session, so I'm excited.
This is her Super Bowl. Her Cowboys aren't in it anymore.
I'm done, yeah.
So the legislative session is Hannah's Super Bowl.
You can find as much excitement there as you have.
I do. Ask anybody. I get all excited. PVW is my favorite.
Yes. Yeah.
So the big deal is getting the money needed to help clear out the 8,000 untested evidence of rape kits in the state's backlog. That's something that you've been following for a long time, and you finally got a chance to go down to Vancouver and get a look at where they do the testing. So what's the status of this effort to get at that backlog?
So this is an ongoing effort. A lot of things have been happening, and we made some accomplishments this year. We have a tracking system now online for victims, police agencies, anybody that needs to can go on and follow each kit. The problem is that those kits are still moving slowly. So the state attorney general called in an expert who's helped other states and cities across the country really help clear their backlog by setting up these much more efficient labs. And Bruce Siggins, he's the manager of the State Patrol Crime Lab down in Vancouver. I got to meet with him. He says there's really a growing sense of urgency that he's seeing, that everybody wants to get these done more quickly.
I think it's getting better. I think nationwide it's getting better. People are beginning to understand that there are some people out there that unfortunately seems to make this a hobby.
We've seen that in other states where they've cleared the backlog again, that there's been serial rapists, sometimes killers connected to these kits that have sat on shelves for years and years and years. So those future crimes could have been stopped. Sagan says he was there with me when I went to the Vancouver lab last week for this work session with the national DNA expert, as were other lab leaders from across the state. And they pretty much talked about how they wanted to get this dream lab, which is this high throughput lab is what it's called. It cuts the time down from testing of more than a year now to about a month. So it's a huge difference, And Sickens believes it's doable.
I can tell you one thing for sure. Every DNA scientist on the second floor would dance for joy to be able to do that, because that's getting that backlog off their back. And that's being able to say to the prosecutor, well, yes, I'll have that ready for you. You know, and the victims who can track their sexual assault kits through our sexual assault kit tracking system, they're watching that kit move through that system that fast. Oh, that's going to give them comfort.
Now, other states like Ohio have cleared their backlogs with this high throughput model. The Vancouver lab already has an empty space on the second floor to build that high throughput lab, bring in robots and more than a half dozen scientists, and a federal grant of $825,000 to build it. But in order to actually build it, they also need the state to match that money and more. So the State Patrol is asking for $6 million to get the lab built, the staff to run it, and that new high-tech equipment, including the robot. That's where Democratic State Representative Tina Orwell comes in. She was also at this work session with us and she with the lab leaders, you had some hesitation about this.
Change is challenging, right? It takes time for training and to bring in new practices. And I think there's a concern for that the lab staff have that they really want to keep it high quality. And I really respect that. But I do think these other states have been really successful in these other models. And so, you know, I think between the new robotics, the new team models, to doing the direct DNA, which will, again, is very effective to rapidly test sexual assault kids. I think these are things that we haven't fully embraced in our state, which will make a huge difference.
So the new process that in the high throughput lab also allows the scientists to test in a way that they can get DNA uploaded into CODIS, that's the National Crime DNA Database, like right away, which is hugely important to making sure if you're going to identify somebody and keep them off the street.
Right. It's got to be online.
And it takes too long to do that now. So she's got a bill that's got all kinds of stuff in it, including money for the lab and other issues.
I think part of it is having that bigger vision and longer term vision of how we need to support our labs. And so some of the things that the bill includes are timelines around when we would like to see the older kids tested by, as well as time frames of how rapidly to test new sexual assault kids coming in. I think those are the parameters that then can allow the lab to say, what do we need? What do we need to do? What do we need as far as resources to make that happen?
So, and her bill will also have requirements as far as destroying rape kits, which have been issues in other states. People's rape kits have been destroyed. So she's got guidelines for that. Reporting requirements. There'll be a ask for 2-year study to look at all of these investments we've made and see what progress we're making. And she stressed this is a moving target, right? This is a 2-year budget request mm-hmm. to pay for this staff, but we need to do a lot more to keep keep the staff online. One of the things, if we're working at the lab in Seattle, they want to pay people there more because it's so much more expensive to live here, pay for their education, perhaps, to get more trained scientists. A lot of that discussion that went on during this visit I had down there. One of the things that was really cool, the lab manager said, once they get this and they clear this backlog, what they want to use this new high throughput process for, property crimes, right?
Yeah, which don't get investigated from what I understand.
Yeah, absolutely. But they would here, and it would be able to really help match that and get these people off the street as well.
Well, excellent. Now, is the appropriation at all controversial?
We'll see. I mean, there's a lot of money that people want for a lot of things. There's a lot of what I would say are being described as much larger mm-hmm.
priorities. Well, I think it's $6 million.
It's only $6 million. So that was when I talked to Attorney General Bob Ferguson. He basically called this a drop in the bucket when we're talking about it. So
yeah, and people, I mean, property crimes, I mean, people are just so frustrated. They didn't bother calling anymore because they know they're not going to be investigated. So this would at least promise to give them the capacity to actually do those kind of petty crimes.
Yeah,
get these people off the streets.
The lab manager said, so say somebody's in your house and they accidentally rub against something, then they can go in there, they can test that, they can put it in there. And if this guy's doing it more than once, and they can track
exactly.
him down. So, yeah, there's a lot at stake here, and we really need to clear the backlog. So we'll see how it goes when she drops the bill and when the budget and the appropriations is done.
Hannah Scott, thank you.
You bet.